Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up a file that history usually marks with a giant Do Not Disturb sign. We are talking about the period right between the fall of Rome and the year 1000 AD.
Right, the so-called Dark Ages, which is, I mean, it's probably the most persistent branding problem in the history of ideas.
It really is. Mm-hmm. I think most of us have this cartoon in our heads where, you know, Rome falls, the lights go out, and humanity just sort of sits around in the mud for six centuries until the Renaissance happens.
Yeah, just waiting around.
Exactly, yeah. Just waiting for Da Vinci. But looking at the source material we have for today, specifically regarding the history of philosophy, that narrative is not just wrong. It is practically the opposite of the truth.
It is entirely the opposite. Far from being a void, this period was a pressure cooker. And what makes this deep dive into the sources so interesting is that it wasn't happening in a vacuum. You had this massive cross-cultural melting pot.
Right.
You had Jewish, Christian, and Islamic thinkers all operating in parallel, and often they were reading the exact same books.
And basically copying off each other's homework.
In a way, yes, because they were all wrestling with the exact same legacy. They were trying to take the toolkit of Greek philosophy, so Plato and Aristotle mostly, and use it to explain their specific religious texts.
So our mission today for this deep dive is to uncover that shared struggle. We really need to see how these three traditions try to answer the biggest question of all, which is, how does a timeless, perfect God relate to a messy, time-bound world?
And honestly, seeing how they tackled this totally changes how you view the history of religion. They were all essentially asking the same thing. Can we use strict logic to prove religious truths? Or is there a point where logic actually becomes the enemy of faith?
Yeah, and Dr. Arthur Holmes, whose work is really central to our sources today, frames this whole era as a preparatory phase.
Preparatory, right.
Like, these thinkers were defining the battlefield. They were out there sharpening the weapons that the heavy hitters like Thomas Aquinas would use later on.
Exactly. And to understand that battlefield, you really have to understand the two main vibes or the two philosophical flavors that dominated the era. You have the mystical side and you have the logical side.
Or to put it in the sources' actual terms, Neoplatonism and Aristotelianism.
Right. And in the early centuries, so say 500 AD to about 900 AD, the vibe was heavily Neoplatonic.
So let's unpack Neoplatonism first, because it fundamentally changes the whole creation story.
Mm-hmm.
In the standard Western Sunday school version, I think we picture God like a carpenter or maybe a watchmaker.
Right, standing outside the universe.
Yeah, he stands outside the materials, draws up a blueprint, and builds the thing piece by piece.
That is what they call creation. Ex nihilo, creation out of nothing.
Yeah.
But the Neoplatonists, who were influencing everyone from early Christian monks to Islamic scholars, they saw it very differently. They didn't see God building the world. They saw the world flowing out of God.
Flowing?
Yeah, they called it emanation.
The sources use this sun analogy here, which I think is just really helpful.
Mm.
Because the sun doesn't wake up in the morning and decide to make light. It doesn't get out a hammer and build a ray of sunshine. The light just naturally and inevitably flows out of the sun's very being.
Precisely. And that metaphor changes everything about how you see the universe. If the world is an emanation, a ray of light from the divine, then everything is connected in this vast hierarchy.
Like a ladder.
Exactly like a ladder. The further you get from the source, the dimmer things get. You move from God down to the angels, to humans, to animals, and finally all the way down to inert matter.
So matter isn't actually bad in this view. It's just
Dark.
Just dark, yeah.
It is the furthest point from the source. It is the absence of reality in a way. And this brings us to one of the most fascinating and mysterious figures in this whole saga, a writer who appears around 500 AD, calling himself Dionysius the Areopagite.
Pseudo-Dionysius, as the historians call him, which honestly is one of the great identity thefts of all time.
It really is. So in the Bible, in Acts chapter 17, St. Paul converts a philosopher in Athens named Dionysius. Then 500 years later, these writings suddenly appear claiming to be written by that exact guy.
Which they weren't.
They absolutely weren't. They were written by a brilliant Neoplatonic philosopher using a pen name. But because the church genuinely thought they were from a direct student of Paul, they accepted these writings as almost scriptural.
And his big contribution, which stems directly from that sun analogy we just talked about, is how we're supposed to talk about God. He introduces the positive and negative way.
Right. Because God is the source of everything you can speak of him positively. You can say God is good or God is wise because he is the literal source of all goodness and wisdom.
But that's not really enough, is it? Because if I say God is good, I'm usually thinking of good like, you know, that pizza was good or my neighbor is a good guy.
Exactly. Our words are finite. They're simply too small. So Dionysius argues you also need the via negativa, the negative way.
The via negativa.
Right. You have to deny those attributes at the same time. You have to say God is not good, meaning not good in the limited, clumsy way humans understand it. God is not existing in the way a rock exists.
It reminds me of trying to explain a 3D object to a 2D stick figure. Any word you try to use is just inherently going to be wrong.
That is a brilliant way to put it. And for Dionysius, this realization leads straight to mysticism. The goal isn't to write a tidy dictionary definition of God. The goal is to ascend that ladder of emanation past the clumsy words into what he called the divine darkness, to merge back with the one.
So that's the mystical flavor of the era. It is all about flow and hierarchy and returning to the source. But then you have a character who comes along in the 9th century, and he tries to turn this mystical flow into a hard-coded system. John Scotus Erigena.
The Irishman.
The Irishman, yes. He's arguably the smartest guy in Europe between the fall of Rome and the year 1000. And he takes this flowing Neoplatonic idea and builds what he calls the division of nature.
And this right here is where we see that shared struggle really taking shape. Because he isn't satisfied with just having mystical feelings in the dark. He wants a strict logical classification of all reality.
I looked at his chart in the reading, and it reads like a total tongue twister. Let's break down the 4 steps, because it actually explains their entire medieval worldview. So step 1 is the uncreated creator.
That is God, the ultimate source. The sun before it shines, so to speak.
Okay, then step 2 is the created creator.
This is a very Platonic concept. These are the forms or the logos. Think of them as the blueprints or the DNA of reality. They are created by God, but they are the foundational patterns that create everything else.
Okay, got it. Step 3 is the created non-creator.
That is us, the physical world. Trees, rocks, humans. We are made, but we don't create new fundamental realities. We are just the effect of the blueprints.
And finally, the loop closes. Step 4 is the uncreated non-creator.
Which is the big twist. This is God again, but it is God as the goal, the end of the journey. The idea here is that everything flows out from God, moves through history as the universe, and eventually returns to God.
It's a giant cosmic circle.
It is. And notice what he is doing here. He is using rigorous logic to explain a purely mystical process. He is building a system. And that intense desire for a system brings us right to the year 1000 AD and a man named Anselm.
Saint Anselm. Now the whole vibe shifts here. We are moving away from the mystical Irishman to a very precise, a very logical monk.
This is the major pivot point toward the high scholasticism that dominates the later Middle Ages. Anselm has a motto that perfectly defines this shift. Credo ut intelligam.
I believe in order that I may understand.
To the modern ear, that sounds completely backwards. We usually say, show me the evidence and then I will believe you.
Pixar, it didn't happen.
Exactly. But for Anselm, faith is the starting point. He wasn't saying blind faith is best. He was saying, I already have this faith. Now I'm going to use my intellect, which is a gift from God, to explore it as deeply and logically as possible. Philosophy for him was literally an act of worship. It was faith seeking understanding.
And this act of worship produced what is arguably the most famous brain teaser in the history of philosophy, the ontological argument for God's existence.
It is an argument that refuses to die. Philosophers are literally still debating it today.
Okay, let's walk through this carefully. Anselm basically tries to prove God exists purely by defining the word God.
Yeah.
He doesn't look at trees or stars for evidence. He just looks inside his own head.
Right. He starts with a definition. He says, God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Basically, the maximum possible being.
Okay. I have that concept in my head. The ultimate being.
Yeah.
Infinite, perfect, all-powerful.
Now, Anselm asks you a simple question. Is it greater to exist only in your imagination or to exist in your imagination and in reality?
Well, reality is definitely better. If I imagine winning a lottery ticket, that's a nice thought.
Right.
But a real winning lottery ticket in my hand is objectively greater.
Exactly. So Anselm traps you. He says, if this maximum being you are thinking of exists only in your mind, then it isn't actually the maximum being. Because a greater one that actually exists in reality is conceivable.
So if I could think of the greatest being, it must exist. Otherwise, I wouldn't actually be thinking of the greatest being.
You got it. By definition, God cannot just be an idea. He must be real.
That feels, I mean, it feels like a trick. It feels like he just hustled me with words.
You are definitely not the only one who felt that way. There was a monk at the time named Ganilo. He actually called himself Ganilo the Fool, just to play devil's advocate. He immediately pushed back with the perfect island argument.
I love this one. He basically says, okay, Anselm, I can imagine a perfect island. Luscious fruit, perfect weather, no mosquitoes. Does that mean this island must magically pop into existence just because I defined it as perfect?
It's a very solid critique, but Anselm clapped back. He argued that an island is finite. It is part of the created world and it has limits. His argument, he claimed, only works for the necessary being the infinite. You can't use his logic to conjure up pizza or islands.
But there is a deeper problem here, right? The philosopher Immanuel Kant pointed it out centuries later. It's about whether existence is actually a feature you can just add to a list of qualities.
Right, this is the heavy lifting of the critique. Kant argued that existence isn't a predicate. If I describe a car as red fast and having leather seats, those are features. If I add and it exists, I haven't actually added new feature to the concept of the car. I've just said the concept has a real-world counterpart.
But, and this is a key insight from the reading today, Anselm did view existence as a feature.
Yes, he did. And this is why historical context matters so much. In Anselm's worldview, that Neoplatonic ladder we talked about earlier, being is goodness. To be is better than not to be. So for him, existence literally was a perfection.
So the argument really only works if you are already wearing Anselm's glasses.
That is what Dr. Holmes calls system dependence. The argument is bulletproof if you are standing inside Anselm's philosophical system. But if you step outside of it, the logic just dissolves.
Okay, so we've got the West doing its Neoplatonic thing, climbing the mystical ladder to God and playing with definitions. But meanwhile, in the East, something massive is happening, the Aristotelian invasion.
This is the great plot twist of the era. While Europe was busy reading Plato and Augustine, the Islamic world was busy translating and deeply analyzing Aristotle.
And Aristotle is a very different beast. He isn't about mystical ladders at all. He's about biology, physics, categorization.
He is the ultimate scientist of the ancient world. And when his work started filtering back into Europe, mostly through Spain, it caused a massive crisis. You had Jewish thinkers like Maimonides and Muslim thinkers like Avicenna trying desperately to reconcile this rigorous empirical science with their holy books.
And the man who really stirred the pot the most was Averroes.
The great
He
commentator.
didn't just translate Aristotle, he interpreted him. And he found things in Aristotle's logic that made religious people, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian alike, very nervous.
Two big things specifically. First, the eternality of matter. Averroes argued that based on pure Aristotelian logic, the world wasn't created out of nothing at a specific moment in time. Matter has just always existed.
Which directly contradicts Genesis and the Quran pretty heavily.
Completely. And the second one was even scarier for the medieval mind. No individual immortality.
Wait, so no heaven for me specifically.
Averroes interpreted Aristotle's view of the mind to mean that we all share one cosmic soul or one active intellect. When you die, your individual drop of consciousness just returns to the ocean, that you part, your memories, your personality is gone forever.
That is a massive deal breaker. If there is no individual soul, there's no reward, no punishment, no salvation. The whole religious project basically falls apart.
Exactly. So the question is, how did Averroes handle this conflict? Because he was a religious judge himself.
He came up with the twofold truth, right?
That's how it was labeled by his critics, anyway.
Yeah.
The idea was that religion speaks in metaphors and allegories designed for the common people just to keep them behaving well. But philosophy speaks the precise, literal truth for the educated elite.
Wow. So essentially, you guys keep your nice stories and we will handle the actual facts.
Essentially, yes. And when these ideas cross the border into Europe, what historians call Latin Averroism, it caused an absolute panic. You had professors at the University of Paris openly teaching this double truth. The church realized very quickly they couldn't just ignore Aristotle anymore. They had to fight him on his own turf.
Enter Bonaventure.
Bonaventure is the ultimate backlash. He is a Franciscan monk, and he looks at this Aristotelian threat and says, absolutely not. He completely rejects the idea that you can just use reason alone to find the ultimate truth. He goes right back to Plato and Augustine.
What was his main counterattack, though? Because he couldn't just say, I don't like it. He had to actually argue philosophically against the best science of the day.
He argued for divine elimination. Think of the human mind like a perfect physical eye. You can have 20/20 vision, that's your God-given reason. But if you are standing in a pitch-black room, you still can't see anything.
You need a light source.
Exactly. Bonaventure argued that God is the light source. Without the divine light illuminating your mind, Aristotle is just stumbling around in the dark. He can measure the walls of the room perfectly, but he can't see what is actually inside it.
And what about the soul? How did Bonaventure save the individual person from getting absorbed into Averroes' cosmic ocean?
This is a really beautiful piece of reasoning. Bonaventure argued that because God is entirely perfect, his knowledge must also be perfect. Therefore, God doesn't just know humanity as a vague general category. He knows individuals.
Because to know something perfectly is to give it reality.
Right. He argued that every individual has a unique form, a specific, unrepeatable combination of qualities that makes them them. Because God knows that unique form eternally, the individual soul, has a permanent reality. It doesn't dissolve back into the ocean.
So he used a very complex philosophical mechanic just to save the simple idea of a personal heaven.
He is fighting fire with fire. He is using high-level philosophy to defend Orthodox faith against the new philosophy.
So let's zoom out and look at this whole journey. We started with the Dark Ages, which, as we've seen, were actually full of literally the light of emanation. We saw Dionysius and the mystics trying to climb the ladder back to the One.
Then we saw Anselm trying to prove God with pure definitions, turning faith into a rigorous logical exercise.
And finally, the explosion. Aristotle arrives via Averroes, bringing science and logic that seems to completely contradict faith, leading to Bonaventure slamming on the brakes.
And this creates the perfect cliffhanger for the history of philosophy. Because right now in our story, we have a massive standoff. Faith and Augustine are on one side, logic and Aristotle are on the other. They seem entirely incompatible.
The medieval world is basically waiting for someone who can synthesize them. Someone who can step up and say, maybe Aristotle and the Bible are actually both right.
We aren't going to talk about him today, but we are looking directly at you, Thomas Aquinas.
Indeed we are. But before we wrap up, there is one last provocative thought from Dr. Holmes that I think is really worth chewing on. It goes back to Anselm.
Yes, the idea of system dependence.
We looked at Anselm's proof for God. It seemed completely logical to him. But it seems a bit circular to us today because we don't share his underlying assumptions. We don't view existence as a perfection on some cosmic ladder.
It makes perfect sense from the inside, but it falls apart from the outside. And that forces us to ask a really difficult question as modern people. How many of our own logical beliefs today are just system dependent?
That is genuinely unsettling. We walk around thinking we're being purely rational, but are we just operating inside an invisible cultural system that secretly defines what true or logical even means for us?
Are we just the Anselms of the 21st century, totally confident in our logic simply because we can't see the water we're swimming in?
Well, on that existential note, we will leave you to ponder your own reality. Thank you for listening to this deep dive into the medieval mind.
Until next time.
See ya.